When one thinks of Martin Luther King Jr. and his life, the man's refrigerator and its contents is not what leaps to most people's minds. Then again, Charles Johnson is not most people. He's a writer, a professor, and a cartoonist. Some call him a philosopher folklorist. He's also among the country's best novelists. He may be best known for the book Middle Passage, which won the National Book Award in 1990. In his hands, Martin Luther King's refrigerator becomes a mechanism to examine race and culture. It's also the title story in a newly issued collection. On this, the last day of Black History Month, Charles Johnson joins us to explore the use of fiction to understand history. What novels or works of fiction have helped you better understand the Black American experience? Join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Charles Johnson joins us now from the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
The incident sounds like something you might have gone through. I had an epiphany while making a snack. How much of that story is Reverend King, and how much is you?
Well, it's very hard to sort that out because I identify with King so closely. You know, it might be helpful if I told you how some of the stories in this collection were written.
Sure.
There are 8 stories altogether in Dr. King's refrigerator and other bedtime stories, but 5 of the stories were written specifically for an event here in Seattle called Bedtime Stories, which is a fall fundraiser sponsored by the Washington Commission for the Humanities, which is now called Humanities Washington. 6 years ago, I'm on their board. They came up with the idea of having writers read original works in support of programs that they do for literacy and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, wouldn't it be an interesting idea if we had several writers come together, you give us a theme or a topic, and we write to that. So over the last 6 years, several writers have shown up to write original works, among them playwright August Wilson, writers Laura Kalpakian, writers David Shields and Tom Robbins, and many, many others. So in the spring, they gave us a topic. The first year, it was just bedtime stories, and I wrote a story called Sweet Dreams, which is in the collection. It's about the future and people's dreams being taxed. The second year, it was insomnia was a theme, and I wrote a story called Better Than Counting Sheep, which I think academics like a lot. And the third year, the story was A Good Night Kiss. I wrote a story called Cultural Relativity. And the fourth year, the theme or topic that they gave us was A Midnight Snack, right? So we went home over the summer. We had to come up with something that was tailored to that particular idea. You know, it's a great event because we all come together. We don't know what any other writer has written, but we know we've all written to the same topic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I struggled with it. I said, what am I going to do for a midnight snack? Well, the first thing I started thinking of was, well, what's food? What really is food? Where does it come from, right? What's the metaphysics of food? And I did a little bit of research, and then I said, okay, who's going to tell this story? Well, it seemed to me that if you investigate how we get food, which is, you know, basically what keeps us alive, you see the presence of so many other people involved, really the rest of the planet. And one of King's lines came to me. You know, he said, when you get up in the morning, you get your coffee, right? You shower, you towel yourself off. You know, well, the towel comes from a certain country, right? The coffee comes from South America. Before you walk out your door, King said, you have depended on half the rest of the world. So I simply knew at that moment, King had to be the protagonist. But the story is set about a year before the Montgomery bus boycott, when King is still a young graduate student, and only he and Coretta have only been married for 1 year. So there's issues, you know, going on. He's got to finish his dissertation. Is he spending too much time, you know, away from his marriage? And he's working late one night, actually on a sermon, and he decides to get a midnight snack. And that's when he opens the refrigerator and we get the revelation.
Working on the sermon, incorporating a figure from history puts whatever that idea, the contents of that refrigerator, in an entirely different context.
I guess it does. There are 2 stories that are historical in this collection. There's one on Dr. King, and then there's one on the last year in the life of Descartes, which I think is a wonderful story because he spent that last year with Queen Christina of Sweden, who was a Renaissance character, just a remarkable human being. But, you know, one of the things that's important to point out, I think, right now, because it is the last day of Black History Month, is that so much of Black history, you know, has been marginalized. So much of it is not known. So every writer that I know who's a serious writer is a passionate student of history. And we rely on the historians to give us, you know, what's in the historical record. You know, people like Stephen Oates and Taylor Branch and LaRond Bennett Jr. And on the basis of their research and scholarship, which we are eternally indebted to, the writer can begin to imagine, you know. He can go places that the historian cannot. He can think of a knight, you know, in King's young life when he's 25 years old and opens a refrigerator and has a revelation. You know, it's a very quiet story. All the stories in the collection are kind of light entertainments. As I said, five were written, you know, to be read to an audience. But that's what writers do. They look at history to see, you know, not always the major events. You know, in my novel Dreamer, I looked at the major campaign that the King had in Chicago in 1966. But if you look just off to the side in the historical record, you find anecdotes and little stories that have never been dramatized, especially in Black American history, you know. If you look at my other collection, Soul Catcher, there's a story I had a chance to write about Martha Washington that I just loved. It just came from one line in the historical record, where it was said that, you know, George Washington didn't like being a slave owner. Mm-hmm. So he made arrangements for his slaves to be freed upon his death and Martha's. Well, he dies, right? So all the slaves there, I guess it's at Mount Vernon, know that when Martha dies, they're free. So she is living in terror after George's death and hurries up and frees her own slaves, right? I mean, that's a little story. But in the little stories, you sometimes find all the resonance and meaning, you know, of the larger historical event, and also an insight into those historical figures.
Let's get some callers on the line. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking with novelist and story writer Charles Johnson. And let's talk with Clayton. Clayton's calling from Auburn, North Carolina?
Newbern,
excuse me.
Yeah, and I was saying the novel that I think interested me the most and sort of gave me an interesting perspective on history is actually an account of alternate history by Stephen Barnes. The name of the novel is Lion's Blood, and the sequel is called Zulu Heart, both excellently written in terms of description and plot development. What it does, it tells the history of an alternate America where, due to a series of events, the transatlantic slave trade takes place, or is basically run by Africans, with the commodity, for lack of a better word, being Europeans, specifically Celtic Gaelic individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And but not only that, it also depicted the relationship between two individuals of different races who have a friendship in spite of the surrounding circumstances. Then there's the development of technology that happened, and it gives the understanding that human spirit is the human spirit, and technology, love, concerns all come about, develop, regardless of what is the ruling or who is the ruling class. I thought that was powerfully developed in the way he told the story.
Charles Johnson?
I'd love to respond to Clayton. Stephen Barnes is an old friend of mine. He also participated in Humanities Washington's Bedtime Stories, along with his wife, Tanana Reeve Dew, who is a writer of horror fiction. And I remember when Steve was writing that book, he now lives in California. He's returned there, but he lived out here in Washington State for a number of years. Steve spent 2 years on Lion's Blood. I endorse the book. My blurb is on the back of the hardcover edition. And he did a tremendous amount of research. He brought lots of scholars together, had a big party, told them what he needed, and he wrote Lion's Blood, which is probably the only alternate universe story in terms of a novel that we have by an African-American writer. He and Octavia Butler, who also lives here, are two of the finest science fiction writers that I know of working today.
Mr. Johnson, I have to say that I guess an amateur aspiring writer myself. And
good.
You know, Stephen Barnes' website has influenced me tremendously and has given me tremendous encouragement. I've been doing a whole lot of work in trying to get some stories out. But the concept of picking something out of history, case in point, the Tuskegee affair, the Tuskegee experiment, and making a story out of that, just, you know, like going off on a tangent and creating a world, a universe that sort of changes the perspective of others.
You're talking about the syphilis experiment, not the Tuskegee Airmen, of course.
Precisely.
Yeah. Okay, yes. Clay.
Precisely.
Thanks very much for the
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Sherry. Sherry's calling from Portsmouth, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a playwright, and I do here in Hampton Roads a lot of our local history, which dates back to before the Revolutionary War. And what I found is that because this history is our own personal history, people are oftentimes very resistant to that. But it's probably the best way to talk about a difficult history is through the arts. And we take plays that feature Nat Turner, who, 50 miles from where I live, carried out his insurrection in 1831. And we put Nat Turner in a wax museum with Harriet Tubman and Harriet Beecher Stowe, Abe Lincoln, and a museum curator has brought a Confederate flag. And these eight figures from history debate whether or not to allow this flag to remain in their place of residence. And this allows us an opportunity to talk about a difficult history in a way that's productive for the current, for the present. And I applaud Mr. Johnson very much, and I'm a great admirer of your work. And
thank you.
Hope that, you know, here in this area that we could use the model of Seattle as a way of dealing with history, because I find that I get a lot of resistance to this because, again, it is the personal history here, and it's very sensitive for a lot of folks in regard to that. And I guess I just wanted to just get some confirmation that we're on the right track in terms of continuing to persist with this, because it seems to be important. And particularly when we go into the schools, students are really pleased to hear about this history that is their local history. When we tell students that this area was a major stop on the Underground Railroad because of the ports and because of the Great Dismal Swamp, they're fascinated and they're thrilled by this information.
Yes.
This crosses all color lines and ethnic lines and economic lines, and so it's important to do this, and I thank you much for sharing this. I thank Talk of the Nation for sharing this information with all of us out here, because every local town has history that needs to be discussed.
I should point out the Great Dismal Swamp is not a metaphor for Washington, D.C.
But well, could be.
Well, it's a real place, too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call, Sherry. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry.
We're talking about fiction and history with Charles Johnson. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to ask you about something you wrote in the introduction to a paperback edition of Oxherding Tale. Which you describe as not only your first novel, but your first seven novels.
It's actually my second novel. I wrote six before my first one, Faith in the Good Thing, very quickly in 2 years. And the first novel was Faith in the Good Thing in 1974, Oxherding Tale. I spent about 5 years on, so it came out in 1982.
Yeah, but you were writing then about a new generation, a younger black and white critics eager to move beyond protest fiction and the literature of gender and racial victimization, which was beginning to ossify by the mid-80s, turning to the novel as a springboard to broaden their discussion of blackness and being. What did you mean by that?
What did I mean by that? Well, I don't know. No, actually, I do know. What I meant is that there was a transition, I think, that happened in the 1970s away from the kind of protest fiction that we saw during the Black Arts Movement and earlier. You know, a lot of the protest fiction is segregation-era fiction, and we have to keep that in mind. There were lots of things to protest right through 1965 when we had the Voting Rights Act, for example, after the Civil Rights Act of 64. But after that, our literature had the potential to open up and explore far more of the human experience than just questions of racial oppression. And I think we've seen some of the fruits of that in the last 30 years. I was kind of there early, you know, poking around and promoting that with my belief that we need a very strong philosophical fiction. But we have other writers today looking to other genres in which they work. Black Americans are working in all genres right now. Earlier, you know, Clayton mentioned Stephen Barnes. Well, you know, he works in science fiction. Tanana Reeve Dew in horror fiction. You have black people writing in every genre imaginable, about every subject imaginable. So for me, that is literary, intellectual, and aesthetic evolution.
Here's some emails we've gotten. This from Aaron Martin. Two great books that opened up African-American history for me were Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, The Effects of the Murder of the Four Girls at the Birmingham Church, and Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. Each chapter reviews the life of African-Americans in different eras. This from Mary. The book The Color Purple had a major impact on me when I read it as a young woman. Alice Walker's book was so small, yet written with such intensity, beauty, pain, and full of every type of emotion. Just a beautiful book, and the movie almost compares. I cry every time I see the movie with tears of joy for the reuniting of mother and child and the message that what goes around comes around. And Jeremy from Ann Arbor, Michigan wrote, I just read To Kill a Mockingbird this month, which I started simply because I procured a copy the library was giving away. I hadn't read it. Catching up on the classics has been a New Year's resolution for me. This poignant American classic could not have been more appropriate for Black History Month. I don't know if any of those books would figure in, given your age. Perhaps not. Were there any books you read as a kid that had an important influence on you in this regard?
Oh, well, certainly one of the big impacts on me, as it has been on several generations, is Ralph Ellison's magisterial Invisible Man. It is a complex novel. It's multi-layered. It is inexhaustible. You can read that book when you're, say, 18 or 19. You can read it again when you're 28 or 29 and find more meaning, more levels of meaning. And you can come back to it again about every 10 years and check your own... Oh, I guess complexity against the book's complexity, and also check our nation.